KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and for this coming academic year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm thrilled to have back two repeat guests on Hearsay Culture. You know, I can't say I have favorites because there's lots of people out there who do great work, but I'm definitely a fan of my two guests today's work, and so I'm delighted to have them back. James Grimmelman is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, and David Post is a professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. They are the authors of a brief that appeared to be relied upon heavily in the dissent in the recent copyright law Supreme Court case, American Broadcasting Companies v. Aereo. This was an opinion that was that came down in late June. We're recording the show on July 8th, so a couple of weeks ago. It was a 6-3 decision where the majority opinion was authored by Justice Breyer, and a dissent was authored by Justice Scalia. Aereo, and we're going to be diving deep into this decision in the first roughly two-thirds of the discussion today. Aereo was a case involving the public performance of copyrighted works through what looked like DVR-type Roku devices. In this case, the service was Aereo, which operated an internet-based application that transmitted television station signals through the internet. And in Aereo, the Supreme Court held that this was a violation of the Copyright Act's Transmit Clause, and that Aereo had violated the Copyright Act's Transmit Clause, violated the Constitution, violated the statute, which is based upon the Constitution, when it sells its subscribers a complex service that allows them to watch television on the internet. Now, for those of you that have listened to Hearsay Culture regularly, those of you that pay attention to internet law, this should sound like a familiar problem, because this issue has come up in cases, certainly at the federal appellate level, in cases like Cablevision, where the question became whether, in fact, one who records or copies something created and transmitted by a cable company through a content provider is violating the Copyright Act by storing it on a disk drive or on some kind of media storage capacity within their home, in a DVR box, or in the cloud, or elsewhere, whether that's a copyright problem, whether the retransmission of content over the internet is a violation of copyright law. And, of course, this issue is primarily important because we have new technologies that are being launched, certainly, you know, monthly, if not weekly or daily, that use the internet and use our modern technology in ways to make access to content easier and more convenient and perhaps illegal. And so in Aereo, this question came up, and the Supreme Court went through a dense and somewhat controversial analysis of the issue, both at the majority level and then at the dissent. Now, those of you who are listening carefully will then, of course, note that David and James took a position that was not the prevailing opinion of the Supreme Court. We're not going to spend, or at least I don't intend to spend the next two-thirds of an hour bashing the Supreme Court, but there's going to be a fair amount of analysis and criticism, perhaps, of the Supreme Court's opinion here. But we're going to delve deeply into what the Aereo opinion is with, again, authors of a brief that was signed by a number of IP professors and that, as I said, was relied upon or repeatedly relied upon heavily by Justice Scalia. For the latter third of the discussion, we're going to focus on a tangentially related issue, and I say it's tangentially related because it also involves the internet, which is the recent study that was published that used data collected from Facebook users involving the question of what the impact is on users when the news stories that pop up on a Facebook user's news feed are positive or negative. And this study has become a cause of concern, primarily, at least in my view, because of issues of notice, because it wasn't entirely clear, or it is not clear, that Facebook indicated to users that this study was happening. And so the manipulation of Facebook users has caused concern from a number of scholars, including James. And so we're going to spend some time in the latter third of the show discussing this issue of Facebook and social media, and manipulation and notice and contract and so forth. So we have a couple of really terrific topics to discuss today. I'm excited to have both James and David on. For those of you that aren't familiar, starting with James, James is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Maryland's Institute for Advanced Computer Studies. He was previously at New York Law School and at Georgetown. He has written extensively in a variety of areas involving software and copyright. He had a piece on class actions. He also, and this is my own moniker, has become the national expert on Google book search and that issue. Pretty much any issue that James gets involved in, he seems to become the expert on, which is a blessing, because James's insights are often and usually very useful, both from an academic perspective and a policy perspective. He has been blogging since the early days, since 2000, at laboratorium.net, and he also has a homepage at james.grimmelman.net. David Post is, as I mentioned, a professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. He teaches IP and the law of cyberspace. He was an early scholar in this field. In fact, David was on a few years ago involving his book Jefferson's Moose, which is a really fascinating comparison of internet law ideas to some of the founding fathers' concepts, including Jefferson. He is a fellow at the Center for Democracy and Technology, a fellow at the Institute for Information Law Policy at New York Law School. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and he's a contributor to the Vala Conspiracy blog. By way of disclosure and caveat, David and I work together heavily in opposition to SOPA and PIPA. So while there is some inside baseball going on in terms of, yes, it won't shock listeners to know that I tend to generally agree with James and David on their views on these issues, I say that by way of disclosure because first and foremost I make the show journalism, and therefore I try to be as objective as possible. So with that in mind, somewhat longer introduction. David is joining us via Skype from Vermont. James is joining us via Skype from his home in D.C. We're recording on July 8th. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Good to be here. It's a great pleasure.
So let's start off. You've both been on the show, so I'm not going to go back into your backgrounds in any great detail, but rather I'll ask you why you came together to work on authoring a brief in the Aereo decision. So perhaps I'll direct that question first at James and then David if you want to add anything.
In my case, I'd been following interesting cases about odd new internet business models. People stringing together different kinds of devices and software to do different things with video. So I've been looking at the Zadiva case. There were interesting issues involving my MP3 tunes and, of course, Cablevision. So when Aereo came down the pike, I just started following the case closely. And so as it went up from the district court to the Second Circuit to the Supreme Court, I was reading the briefs and watching what happened at each level. And at some point I realized, oh, this is important. I should probably do what I can to contribute to resolving the case well. And at that point, starting to think about who should write amicus briefs, it was also obvious that David was following the issues very closely, and I'll turn it over to him.
Yeah, I sort of the same thing. I had written a brief, an amicus brief, again, sort of a law professor's sign-on brief in the Cablevision case in the Second Circuit, which is, I guess, back in 2008, raises many of the issues that came up again in Aereo. So I was interested in the issues. When we were, I guess the division between us, you know, so we were both following this case independently. I actually had also written a brief in the Second Circuit Aereo case, although that concerned a very, very narrow little issue of statutory interpretation. It didn't really bite off, didn't take a position on the underlying merits of the case in any significant way. But obviously I was interested in the underlying issues in the case. It seemed to me to raise important copyright law questions. I think it was interesting that we agreed to sort of write this jointly. My recollection is that I was a little nervous about taking the full laboring oar on the brief, and when James and I talked, and it was apparent we were both interested in it, I sort of just wanted to make sure, I didn't think I had the time to really do in the time that we had to really do, I knew this was a complicated case, and I was worried about myself trying to cover all of the issues. So we sort of made a blood brother pact of some kind, you know, we divided it up pretty quickly as to which issues each of us would cover. Off we went. We did a lot of editing back and forth, of course, of each other's stuff. But I think we came up with, I'm rather proud of that brief. I think it was a good piece of work. And we did get a fair, I think we had 36 law professors signing on before we finally submitted it to the court.
And the world of herding cats, of course, comes up regularly in trying to get law professors to agree on anything. So that is that is a very respectable number. So mazel tov there. So David, perhaps I'll start with you, and you know James, of course, you know, chime in as well. But I gave a very cursory overview of the facts of Aereo, and I think in order to have any intelligent discussion, particularly for those that aren't familiar, we need to talk about the basic facts. So perhaps David, you could give an overview of the scenario, and perhaps James, I'll ask you the follow up, which is perhaps if you could place it contextually. Or this fact pattern in the recent fights on copyright performance and new technology. So, David, starting with the facts, please.
Yeah, it is actually, fortunately, I think, pretty simple. I think, and everybody agreed on both sides, agreed pretty early on as to what the facts were. Aereo has a facility, was operating out of a facility that... a building in which it had installed a number of these circuit boards of its own manufacture that contained, in effect, a series of little teeny antenna, very much like the kind you might put up on your roof to receive over-the-air television broadcasts, the signals that are being transmitted over the air by the broadcast network. They'd have a series, hundreds, of these little tiny antennas, each of which, in effect, was attached to a little teeny tiny DVR. And what it was selling to the public was access over the internet to a subscriber would obtain access over the internet to one of these little antenna DVR combinations, so that you could do what you can do with a typical sort of antenna and DVR, actually. You could sit at home and say, you know, I want to record some show that's the World Cup game this afternoon if it's being broadcast over Fox, which I believe it is, or ABC. Anything that's being broadcast over the air, you know, turn on at 5 o'clock, record for 3 hours, and then stop. And then you could come home at 11 p.m. and log back on, hit the virtual play button, and the service would stream what you had recorded back to you. That's the basic outline of the system. The question, the reason this was a hard case, I think, was because it simultaneously is. You can make an argument that simultaneously it is infringing and it is not infringing the copyright protection in the stuff that is being broadcast. Aereo said, we're just a sort of antenna and DVR service platform. We are doing for consumers what they can do for themselves. They can pull down signals off the air with an antenna. Millions of people do that. They can send those signals to a DVR and record. Millions of people do that. And they can play back, time shifting, later for later viewing. Millions of people do that. People do that all the time. We have just made this using, rather clever technology and internet distribution. We have made this more convenient and more efficient. And if it's not infringing for the consumer to do it, why should it be infringing of copyright when we just help the consumer to do it? That was their basic argument. The broadcasters, on the other hand, point to a number of provisions in the Copyright Act involving cable services which retransmit television signals to their subscribers. many people obtain ABC and Fox and NBC and the other broadcast networks through their cable system. When the cable system pulls in the over-the-air signal and retransmits it to its subscribers, it pays a royalty to the broadcasters, because without that royalty, it would be infringing the copyright in those broadcasts. The Copyright Act has a series of very complex provisions, providing that cable systems retransmitting broadcast television signals are infringing copyright unless they pay a royalty. And in fact, the statute gives them a compulsory license, a statutory license to do that, at a set rate, a rate that is set in the statute. So the broadcasters say, hang on a second, you're not just an antenna and a DVR service, you're a cable system. You're doing what the cable systems do, retransmitting over-the-air broadcasts, and you should, like they do, you should pay us for that. Not incidentally, those fees have become quite significant. There's a significant portion of network broadcaster revenues over the years. It's a big chunk of money they get from the cable systems for the privilege of retransmitting the broadcast signals to consumers. So the broadcasters say, Aereo, you're just like a cable system. That's what you're doing. You also are infringing our copyright, and can't do that without our authorization. And the odd thing about this case is that they were both pretty persuasive stories, and the court had to choose between them.
James, with that overview of the facts, perhaps you could situate this decision in the larger context of copyright law and internet policy. But of course, this is just not about one relatively uncontroversial company that happened to run or arguably run afoul of copyright law.
Yeah, Aereo, in the long scheme of things, is a blip, and the long-term trend here is that broadcast is going away as a medium of communication between creators and consumers. We're going to rely on internet distribution and the model of using the spectrum to send out these signals to lots of people who aren't paying any attention to them. We're going to stop doing that. So it's a blip. But in terms of understanding how we draw that line, the line at a very high level of abstraction between somebody who is transmitting and making material available and somebody who is helping people store material that they already have access to, that line is incredibly important for a lot of businesses. And the Copyright Act deals with that through a series of interlocking definitions, of which the transmit clause is one part. So a lot of people have been looking to this case to get guidance on how businesses that are innovating in the space around media can navigate that distinction. What do they have to do to stay on the legal side of the line and be certain that they're not sinking, as Aereo did, $100 million into something that will be ruled illegal?
So let me, David, come back to you. And again, as you mentioned, you and James co-authored a brief. The division of labor, as you've described it to me, is such that I will ask you, David, to just, and again, I mean, this, I recognize that any question I ask now, particularly of a law professor, could be a 30-minute lecture. And as much time as we have on Hearsay Culture, I don't have that kind of time. So in a couple of minutes, perhaps you could give an overview of the argument that James and you offered to the Supreme Court with regard to the transmit clause, starting with a little more detail on what exactly it is.
The transmit clause set, let me start actually a little bit before the transmit clause.
Sure.
Copyright owners have a series of exclusive rights to do certain things with the copyrighted content, to reproduce it, to distribute copies of it to the public, and to publicly perform it. So think of the episode, the example we used in our brief, last January 21st episode of The Good Wife, broadcast over the air. Whoever owns the copyright in that audiovisual work. It's an audiovisual work for purposes of the Copyright Act, the show, the program. And whoever owns a copyright in that has the exclusive right to publicly perform it. The transmit clause says it is a public performance to transmit a performance of the work to the public. That was the, so the issue in this case, very simply, was Aereo transmitting performances of these copyrighted audiovisual works to the public? If so, it's infringing the copyright owner's exclusive rights. If not, it's not. The critical argument then really boiled down to whether what Aereo was doing, it's not too controversial to say that Aereo is transmitting performances to some people when it sends out the signal. You know, I've recorded The Good Wife. When Aereo sends it to me, there is a, you know, later that evening, there is a transmission of the performance that goes to my computer. The hard question in the case was whether Aereo was transmitting those performances to the public, because we argued, Aereo argued, and we supported that argument, we thought and think it was correct, that these were private performances. This was Aereo was a service in which hundreds, thousands, or millions of individual private performances got aggregated together in one service. That's called efficiency and innovation. You're bringing together what was a very inefficient distribution system and making it more efficient. And each individual subscriber had control over each individual transmission, so that when I pressed play, there was the on my computer attached to the Aereo server to watch The Good Wife. There was a transmission of a performance, but it was a transmission of a performance that was a private performance. And private performances are not within the copyright owner's exclusive rights. They don't have the exclusive right to privately perform the copyright work. So we made the argument that that was, that Aereo was involved in a large number of private performances that do not add up to transmissions to the public. They are transmissions to the private, if you will, lots of them. And that was related, I think I'm actually going to call on James here, because that was this notion that this is a lot of private performances that the consumer is activating these performances for himself or for herself, and they're private. That was closely linked to another argument that we made on Aereo's behalf, which is that this is really a case about the individuals. It is the individual consumers who are performing here and not Aereo. That Aereo is just providing, in effect, a technology to allow the individual consumer who controls the recording and the playback to do what he's authorized to do. And that was sort of in James's portion of the brief, he made that argument or expanded upon that argument. And I think they were closely linked. These were private actions, lots of private actions, and that does not equal public action.
So there's more than one way to look at what Aereo is doing. And, of course, the way that the broadcasters described it makes it sound very much like a cable broadcaster. But that's only if you accept the premise of their argument that we start the analysis and end the analysis with Aereo. And as we know from cases like Sony, that's far from the only way to look at copyright cases. In many cases involving multiple parties, the framework of copyright doctrine worked out by the court says we identify a direct infringer. We ask who bears the most proximate relationship to the making of the copies or the other allegedly infringing acts. And once we've sorted out that party's liability, we step back and we ask who else might be liable as a secondary infringer. So, in many cases, the defendant who's being sued isn't the alleged direct infringer. That's the structure of Sony, in which Sony wasn't directly copying anybody's movies. It was merely selling devices to consumers that allowed the consumers to make copies. The entire structure of Sony depends on that distinction, because the court first says that some uses of the VCR are fair use or otherwise non-infringing. Others might be infringing, but Sony could only, if at all, be held secondarily liable. And the famous Sony rules, the court won't impose secondary liability where a device has significant non-infringing uses. If you look at what the courts have done with the division between direct and secondary infringement in the decades since Sony, the dominant line of cases is the so-called volitional conduct rule, that a operator of an automated system that makes copies only in response to a specific request from a user will be held not to have had the necessary volition to make copies and be treated as a direct infringer. The phrasing in terms of volition is a little bit unfortunate. It brings together some tort concepts that might not be quite appropriate here, but the central idea is entirely sound. When you have a system that could be used to copy different things, and somebody else comes in and puts that to use, making copies of something copyrighted, we start the analysis with that person. We look at who uses the photocopier, who uses Aereo's service. And if you look at the case that way, you say, all right, consumers are using this to record programs for later viewing. Is that infringing? Potentially, yes. It involves the reproduction right. There are private performances when people watch the video themselves. They're definitely reproductions. Then we ask, is that a fair use? Under Sony, a great deal of time shifting will be. Are there other uses of the system that aren't protected as fair use? Well, it's not impossible. Someone might have signed up for Aereo service from a geographically remote location by giving Aereo a false address. That person might potentially be using it to send signals remotely in a way that the courts might treat as unfair. But you can only get there by doing the full fair use analysis, walking through the factors, going through a careful discussion of all of the contextual facts. And once you've done that, you have to ask whether Aereo meets any of the tests for secondary liability. The courts have spent a lot of time working this out. That's what Sony is about. That's what Grokster is about. You work through the elements of contributory, vicarious, and inducement liability. So our brief argued the broadcaster's invocation of direct liability for violation of the public performance right by Aereo was an attempt to short-circuit that analysis, to throw out of the discussion all kinds of facts that make what users are doing with Aereo more sympathetic, and to keep those inconvenient facts out of the litigation.
We're chatting with James Grimmelman of the University of Maryland School of Law and David Post of Temple University School of Law on KTSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KTSU-FM, which is Stanford University's nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KTSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the show. So gentlemen, as you know, I don't mean to throw salt in a wound, but your arguments did not win the day. The majority, again, in the 6-3 decision authored by Justice Breyer, held that Aereo was publicly performing, that therefore, to make it simple, they violated copyright law. And as David alluded to, that has done pretty bad things to their business model. Let me ask you this question. You know, in terms of the impact, and David, perhaps I'll turn to you. You know, the brief itself appeared to be relied upon by Justice Scalia, which is Well, I'll ask you, are you surprised by that? I mean, in the context of recent Supreme Court decisions and Supreme Court jurisprudence with regard to copyright law, what's your take on the fact that it was the minority who seemed to be sympathetic to your arguments in a way that the majority was not? And to be clear, the dissenting opinion was authored by Justice Scalia and Justices Thomas and Alito joined.
Yeah, I mean, lineups are very funny things in intellectual property litigation. There was a surprise. It looks like, from the lineup, it looks like this must have been a case about the rights of criminal defendants or some other sort of ideologically tinged issue with the three, I think it's fair to say, more conservative justices on one side and the other six on the other. I do not know what to make of that. These copyright and IP cases rarely fall out. The ideological lines are very blurry, typically. What was the most interesting part about this lineup, I think, is that Justices Breyer and Ginsburg were on the same side. That's important. Justice Breyer and Ginsburg have had a rather long-standing debate in opinion after opinion over the last 15 or 20 years, I guess now. In copyright cases, they are almost always on, if not other sides of copyright cases, at least concurring for very different reasons, and they're having a public debate about this. Breyer, I think it is fair to say, more generally on the innovation-friendly side of copyrights, worried about copyright's effect on innovators and innovation policy. Ginsburg, more protective of copyright owners' rights. And here they were joined together, again, on the other side, not our side, with Justice Breyer writing the majority opinion, which I think is a very important part of this, this whole case, is that it was Justice Breyer writing this opinion. It's written... I think he was nervous about the effect of this on innovation and innovators. Very nervous. It was very clear in his questions and oral argument that he was very worried about the effects this might have. And as a result, he wrote a very narrow...
David, keep going. Hello?
Should I pick up?
Yeah, why don't you pick it up there, David? James, excuse me, go ahead. Yep.
Another issue that interestingly divided the majority and the dissent was their relative reliance on the purpose versus the text of the transmit clause. I don't think anybody believes the transmit clause is a model of clarity, and Justice Breyer got around that by relying on the legislative history. Congress's expressed intent of trying to protect broadcasters, and thus he comes up with a test that really says aerial looks too much like a cable system. Justice Scalia, who is of course a strong textualist, derides that reliance on legislative history and purpose. Instead, he looks to the text of the transmit clause and concludes that it simply does not cover what aerial is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Scalia expresses some concern about that result, but I think his two responses are, first, that the route we sketched in the brief, that aerial might still potentially be liable under a more apt secondary liability theory, is one that should be taken seriously. And second, that if Congress truly does not like the results of the case, it is free to go back and amend the statute. And that's a healthier relationship between courts and Congress than the courts trying to fill in all of the gaps themselves. So I think that division over interpretive method may actually have driven results in this case as much as views about copyright specifically.
So, James, I this was going to be my follow-up question, so it works conveniently. I certainly hope everything is okay on David's end. Have both of us having children, I think we can relate to what sounded like a crying child appearing, but hopefully all is okay. I wanted to ask you, James, because this is something that you, in fact, you and I have talked about a little bit, and we both teach internet law, and I found it interesting here because as much as this case is about copyright law, it's about new technologies. And yet again, we see the courts using analogies to the physical world, to the non-internet world, in order to understand or make sense of the policy issues and the facts in these cases. And I'm curious to get your reaction to that, because in this case, for example, the dissent goes back to the coffee shop analogy, and perhaps you could talk briefly about what those analogies are. But more specifically, what's your take in 2014 on the continued use of physical world, non-internet analogies to analyze these facts?
Okay. So the dissent relies on a pair of analogies. Compares area of service to video on demand, which is one of the classic scenarios that is thought to be infringing. That somebody buys a library of recorded content and then starts offering it up on request to anybody who wants it. And he then contrasts that with a copy shop, where anybody can bring in material of their own, and the shop makes its services available to let people make reproductions. So Scalia says, which of these is Ariel more like? In truth, it's like a copy shop that also gives its patrons library cards, helps them check out material that they already have the legal ability to get at. You could disagree with that resolution of it in terms of analogies, but at least the analogies are in terms of other copy-implicating behavior. We're trying to look at analogies that we've said about technologies in relation to copyright. Justice Breyer's majority opinion also looks to analogies, but it looks to, I think, a very strange pair. It draws a distinction between a valet who returns cars checked to customers, and a car dealer which sells cars. And this is the point raised in oral argument by the lawyers of the broadcasters, that Aereo is in some sense supposed to be more like a car dealer because it provides people with the car for the first time, rather than a valet because it only gives people their own cars. But that's a metaphor that is profoundly rooted to physical property. It's tied to tangible things that only one person can have at a time. It's bound up with the physical world in a way that makes it hard to understand what its lessons for the intangible world of the internet and copyright are supposed to be. So this leads Breyer to talk about the owner or possessor of a copyrighted work, which is very strange language, because I don't think he quite has in mind either the copyright owner who owns the underlying work, that would be the broadcaster, or the owner of a copy of a work, because who owns a copy? That seems to bring us back to a world in which first sale does all of the work in deciding what the rights of possessors are, and that would be a fairly novel interpretation of the relationship between first sale and the public performance clause.
So before we turn to the Facebook issue, gentlemen, David, perhaps I'll start with you here. So, yeah, I don't like asking crystal ball questions per se, but I'll ask you perhaps I'll call it predictive. Maybe that's just semantics. Give me about a minute, if you would, each of you, James, as well, starting with David, on what you think the impact of the Supreme Court's holding may have on innovation in the technological arena. So, David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think actually not very much. That's what I meant by saying I thought it was very important that this is a Breyer opinion. He goes to great lengths, it seems to me, to try to minimize its scope and its breadth. In particular, I think this is, if you're thinking about going into the broadcast TV space, if you, you know, if you're going to be doing something with broadcast signals that are being transmitted over the air to consumers by the broadcast networks, well, then it will have a significant opinion, a significant impact on your business. But as James said at the very beginning, that's a blip. That is not where the future of content delivery is, not with the broadcast spectrum at all. I think everybody recognizes that. So the impact, I think, outside of that very narrow sphere is going to be very small, I suspect. And that is a very good thing, and I think that was absolutely Justice Breyer's intention in writing the opinion the way he did, was to try to have as little impact on other businesses and other business models as possible.
James?
I hope that is right.
Right.
The opinion emphasizes that it's factually narrow. It doesn't give clear lines to keep that holding confined. So what's going to happen is that this case is going to be cited by copyright owners in a lot of litigation against various new technologies, in which they're going to argue, disregarding any technical differences behind the scenes. That's going to lead to several years of uncertainty. What will happen at the end of it? Perhaps not much, but it certainly gives copyright owners new ways to complicate cases.
So we're chatting with James Grimmelman at the University of Maryland School of Law and David Post at Temple's Beasley School of Law. So we're going to do a bit of a sharp turn here, although still related to technology, James and David, to talk about this this ongoing, as we're recording on July 8th, situation involving this Facebook study. We have about roughly about 15 minutes or so left, so this is what I've called, you might recall, the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions you may not have time to answer adequately, but then, like any good journalist, I ask the questions anyway. The timing is such that while I think this topic could probably be an entire show in its own right, I think it's important that we have the discussion today, given given where the show's going to air. So James, you've written already and blogged about this issue extensively. So perhaps you could give in 3 or 4 minutes the overview of what this issue is and your concerns about it.
So what happened is that a few weeks ago, three authors published a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, describing experiments run on Facebook users, in which Facebook took their news feeds and systematically suppressed either positive stories or negative stories, determined by whether they used happy or sad words, basically. And then Facebook observed these own users' posts and discovered that if Facebook suppresses positive stories that you see, you end up posting slightly fewer positive stories of your own and slightly more negative stories. And the same goes if Facebook suppresses negative stories. So that by manipulating the emotional content of what you see, Facebook can make you happier or sadder, or at least make you appear to be slightly happier or sadder in what you say on Facebook. This study appeared, and it's not the first study involving Facebook. This is probably the biggest controversy any has created because of the underlying research ethics involved. People involved in the study weren't asked if they wanted to be in a study. Indeed, they haven't been told to this day that they were. And the study essentially did not go through the kinds of substantive human subjects research review that ordinary university research would. If you'd conducted a similar experiment out of a university, administered there, you would have had the Institutional Review Board checking to make sure that suitable informed consent in relation to the risks of the study was obtained for the participants. And in here, the IRB essentially took a flyer on it and said, nope, it's an independent experiment conducted by Facebook, not our problem. And the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences took the same attitude. Well, the Cornell IRB looked at it, because they didn't have a problem, we don't have a problem either. Which means you have published research that was never given ethical oversight. And so people are upset, both, I think, about the sense that, oh, Facebook is toying with people's emotions for its own purposes, and also about the larger question of how you do research ethically in an age of massive online services where all the people are, it's very easy to run them.
Your concern, and that maybe I'll ask this question to David, the concern seems to be, based upon what James has said, and I think I've certainly read this elsewhere, right, that there's a lack of notice on the part of Facebook and the authors of this study to let consumers know that this is actually happening. And David, I'll ask you, as someone that's been, you know, observing technology for a long time, you know, why should we be concerned about this? But more specifically, how unusual is this? Because certainly Facebook has had a history already of playing around, for lack of a better phrase, with content and not really telling people. And of course, the privacy settings change daily. Why should we be concerned about this? Or I'll make it even harder: why should someone that isn't on Facebook or doesn't use Facebook be concerned about these issues?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Whether someone who's not on Facebook should be concerned about these issues, I guess because everybody else is on Facebook and is concerned. I mean, you know, Facebook has become a platform. It is not simply just another offering in the consumer's cornucopia of sites on the internet, which are doing all sorts of crazy things in their terms and conditions, or conducting surveys, or recording clicks, or doing a lot of other things. Facebook, I mean, those may be of concern also, but Facebook, I think, raises very special additional concerns because of its ubiquity. I mean, you were talking about a platform on which a great deal of the world's conversation is taking place. This is, as you say, I think, the latest in a saga with Facebook, the privacy issues that have come up. I'm not going to plug this too heavily because it's not the point of your show. But listeners might, well, if you search David Post and virtual representation on Facebook, David Johnson and I published something about a year and a half ago or so, a small little position paper about Facebook needs to take seriously, I think, for its own success, because I think these things threaten. People can leave in a hurry, see MySpace, in a hurry, when things get to a tipping point. And I think Facebook needs to take very seriously that it doesn't really have a way to gauge user preferences about many complicated questions like this one about their Facebook experience. You know, all you can do is leave Facebook. It is exit or nothing, and that's a very, very a crude indicator. It works often in the marketplace. I don't think it works for Facebook's purposes here. I think they need a way to run things like this by their users in some sensible way. And David and I had a specific proposal about how you could get sort of representatives of user views. I think it's in their interest to do it. Because I think people are going, one of these days, one of these is going to really be the bombshell that causes people to say, I'm out of here. And if enough people start doing that, Facebook becomes a lot less interesting and a lot less popular and a lot less profitable.
So, James, let me come back to you on this, and now I'm going to ask the media type explosive question, right? I mean, we see regularly, I mean, the world of social media, even news reporting, that every story has grave consequences for the world. You must see this as the biggest problem, and so forth. So now I'm going to ask a question in that way with regard to this issue. Right? Does, in your view, this experience with this Facebook study suggest a larger and deeper problem, which you know, for lack of a better word, I'm going to call hubris, on the part of large commercial entities, particularly operating in technology space, although quite clearly we can apply it elsewhere, who basically view consumers or their customer base as pliable. We can pretty much do what we want to do because we know that enough people are going to come back and use our services and generate revenue for us such that we don't really have to worry about picayune things that academics worry about, like notice and opportunity to object and so forth. So do you see, I mean, putting aside Facebook in particular, but the larger issue of how commercial entities operate on the internet, that this is part of a larger problem, or have I just literally asked a question that is explosive without much substance?
I think you've put your finger on a reason that this story has taken off and gone viral, as it were. it touches something that people had a sense of about Facebook and other internet companies, but couldn't fully articulate, which is the sense that they are continually running, not just tracking what we're doing, but tweaking the environment to see how we'll respond. And therefore, they're looking really closely at what we're doing, running experiments on us all the time, from a position of immense power and very low accountability. So that when you have that underlying sense, and a story comes out that says they manipulated our emotions, it ties right into that, and it raises questions about that kind of unaccountable power.
And we're chatting again with James Grimmelman of the University of Maryland School of Law, as well as David Post from Temple Beasley School of Law. Gentlemen, we have about 5 minutes left, and I kind of ask a few questions that in an attempt to tie these issues together a little bit. And perhaps, David, I'll come back to you. There's a lot of, I think, with regard to this issue, as well as with regard to Ariel, there's an ongoing debate about market forces and how the market should or should not drive innovation and drive the options that commercial entities and innovators have to serve the public. And obviously, I know you have strong opinions on these issues. Certainly, your affiliation suggests it, and you've written extensively. So I will ask you without loading the – maybe I just loaded the question. But I'll ask the question of you this way. Whether it's the Supreme Court's willingness to wade fairly heavily into the innovative space and copyright law, or it's the possibility that that we could see, although I will acknowledge that this is more this is unlikely to happen, but we'll see more regulation along the lines of what the EU has done with regard to issues like privacy and notice. What's your take, if any, with regard to Aereo and this Facebook situation on this broader question of, for lack of a better phrase, the market being allowed to do its work in the technological space?
It's an interesting and an important and a really hard one to bite off in a short space.
Yeah, because you have about 2 minutes.
The market provides, as I said, the market relies on, you can buy or you cannot buy. You buy from the supplier. If you like what Facebook is selling, buy Facebook. If you don't, go somewhere else. Facebook is in a, as I said before, I think, as with many sort of market imperfections and market failures, quote unquote market failures, Facebook is in a somewhat different position. It is a platform for communication, as much as anything else. It is a group. This whole phenomenon of user generated content and social media, it's nothing but a platform. We provide everything that's there. Everything that makes Facebook interesting is user provided. That's why people flock there. And to simply say that this is, I have no legal or regulatory objection to Facebook doing running its operation more or less the way it sees fit and letting people judge it accordingly. I don't think it's in their interest. I don't think it creates as interesting a community, nearly as interesting a community, as one in which users have more than simply exit to make their voices heard. I think Facebook wants to know what will spark a real rebellion among its users. It should want to know that. Where is the point where people are going to jump ship? And it's in a position to do that, but doesn't seem very interested in doing that at the moment. And as I said, I think it's not in their interests, purely self-motivated private corporation interests, to allow this platform to go on simply under the direction of the Facebook board of directors and the Facebook employees. I don't think that's a smart way to run a community that people will continue to be invested in and to pay attention to. That's my view of it.
James, you want to offer an opinion in about 1 minute on that that question that could take an entire show?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing here is both the upside and the downside of competitive markets, that when you have competition, it is incredibly good at optimizing along the dimensions where there's competition. And we have right now intense competition among these major internet platforms, among things that include user convenience, targeting ads to the people who might be interested in them, and we are seeing really remarkable steps in providing media to people in new ways that are easier and more pleasant to consume. The flip over to streaming is a great example of that. At the same time, I think we're seeing that companies optimize along the lines that the market, the stock market, rewards them for. And so Facebook is being strongly incentivized to perfect its user targeting and its control over users. Everybody is measuring what keeps users on the site and how do we get ad click-through rates as high as possible. And that leads to an attitude of more experiments are good, anything that would slow us down is bad.
James Grimmelman of the University of Maryland School of Law, as well as David Post of Temple's Beasley School of Law. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me today on the show. As I mentioned, you know, the terrific work, and on Aereo, and I probably should have said it up front. I guess I didn't sign your brief, but that's not because I didn't tend to be sympathetic with it. I signed, the brief that Sean Flynn and Margo Kaminsky wrote on the international side of it. Condolences on not winning the day. However, this is only the most recent, as both of you pointed out, battle. But thank you for joining us on the show. Of course, I invite you back as you continue to do this important work. And thank you for joining me today and educating my listeners.
Thank you.
So I have a couple of guests coming up in the remaining portion of this summer quarter on KZSU. Coming up next week is Professor Fred Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, formerly of Harvard's Kennedy School, on the right to know and transparency and the right to privacy, which again, that could just be probably a 15-part lecture series, but we do it in about 50 minutes. Following Professor Schauer, Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz on drone technology and freedom of information. Professor David Columbia of Virginia's Commonwealth University, author of The Cultural Logic of Computation. And then rounding out this summer quarter on KZSU, Mariachi Shaki, member of the European Parliament, from the Netherlands, on democracy and technology in Europe. There's also some future guests that I've started to book, and I do encourage you to come to me through Dave, at hearsayculture.com to offer any suggestions on guests I should have on the show or comments and feedback. James will be interested to know, though James may know this already, I've decided to unintentionally corner the market on all of his colleagues who are directly related to what Hearsay Culture does. So among future guests will be his colleagues, Professor Daniel Citron, author of the forthcoming book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, and Professor Frank Pasquale, who's been on the show before. Actually, Danielle's been on the show as well, discussing his forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, Technologies of Search, Reputation, and Finance. Maryland has put together what I think is arguably the finest faculty on internet law in the country, and I'm excited to have Frank Danielle on the show in the future. You have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter, 2 p.m. Pacific Time, Wednesdays on KZSU FM Stanford. You can stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also listen to the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to our iTunes page where you can get all not only Hearsay Culture shows but events going on at CIS. Again, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening to the show today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.